Sarah Ferguson wasn't able to be with her mother when she died. Her mother was in the UK, and Sarah was in Australia, and it all happened so quickly, so there was no time for Sarah and her brother to slowly come to terms with it. Sarah Ferguson is, of course, an investigative journalist here at the ABC and the presenter of Four Corners. So she's seen more than her fair share of the world's disasters. But this personal disaster completely threw her. She had to get used to a world with the gaping absence of the woman who brought her up, who offered her love and comfort and showed her how to be a decent and curious human being. Sarah Ferguson has written a little book about all this that's simply called On Mother. Hi, Sarah. Welcome back.
Nice to be with you.
How were you told something was up with your mum?
My brother, Anthony, sent a WhatsApp message. I was boarding a plane to come back to Sydney from Melbourne, and it was an odd message because it contained a strange combination of casual and urgent. Call me urgently Tar. So I knew something was up. I did feel a sort of bolt of fear, but I smothered it because I was about to get on a plane, and whatever it was, there wasn't anything I could do about it in that moment. So I waited until we landed, got in a taxi, drove around the horrible outskirts of Sydney Airport and called him. And he went straight to the point, said, "I don't know how to tell you, so I'll just tell you, mother's died." And it was an extraordinary moment, because I think it's the most physical moment that I can recall, even more than childbirth. That sounds like a very strange thing to say, but an extraordinary physical moment.
In what way was that physical?
Because it felt like everything that had held me together for the whole of my life snapped away, went away like 1,000 or 100,000 little tiny ropes and threads of restraint, all just went away very, very, very quickly. I had a picture in my head later of Gulliver rising from his 1,000 little ropes by which the Lilliputians had held him down. And it felt like that everything unraveled in that moment. And I was in the back of a taxi, and a very delicate taxi driver who could hear the animal noises that I was making in the back of the taxi just put his head down and kept driving. And my husband was with me, and he tried to hold me, but I wouldn't let him. So I was thrashing around like an animal, really, in the back of the taxi, making deep noises. My brother was actually driving through tunnels on his way, racing back to England in the night in Italy. And so the signal dropped out. So I had to wait a moment, and in that moment, a little bit of decency, if you like, or normalcy returned, in which I had to think about him and not myself. So I made myself think about him for a moment. But it was just the notion, the fact that she was dead, and the fact that she was dead and alone dead, which caused me to have that extraordinary physical reaction.
What were you told then about the circumstances of her death?
Not a great deal, because my niece and nephew had received the call from the hospital because it had come so late. So my mother, being independent of spirit, hadn't told us that she was going into hospital at all, so we didn't know anything. The hospital had rung my brother's house way too late, so my niece and nephew had found out, raced to the hospital, got there, found that she was dead, so we knew next to nothing at that point.
So she'd been fairly hale then, had she, before you got this phone call? So this must have come as a terrible surprise.
It came absolutely out of the blue. She's 80, so you have to think that she's not going to live forever, except the child in me thought that she would live forever, and certainly I was behaving as if she were going to live forever. She was reasonably hale, so... Although intellectually I knew that she was going to die and it wasn't going to be in 100 years, in my heart it was going to be in 100 years.
Were you like a child again in that moment once you found out about her death?
I wasn't yet like a child. I became one subsequently in the weeks ahead. In that moment I was just a lost thing, a lost thing making noises.
Like an infant, maybe, then, less
maybe,
than a child.
Maybe.
How soon were you then back on a plane going to England, where she was?
A few hours. So a very quick turnaround.
Oh.
And then the very peculiar discombobulation of the long flights. This is something that Australians deal with in all sorts of ways because of where we are. And we jumped on a plane, got on a plane very quickly, and were through the night in one of those weird, horrible... I'm not part of the planet journeys back to England.
Was Tony Jones, your husband, there with you at the time?
Yes. So, and he did a very good, subtle job of preventing me from bumping into anything hard, and I mean that metaphorically. So he created a sort of safe softness around me that meant that I didn't have to deal with anybody careless or unpleasant or bureaucracy or rudeness. He did what he could to sort of keep me safe for the next few weeks. Safe's a funny word, but it's, you know, one of the things in these moments of acute sadness for people, that those people who get it wrong, the rude or the thoughtless, they're such terrible blows. Those people who just get it so wrong, or don't think about the person who's in front of them. And so being protected from that was a very good thing.
Something about being confronted with grief or death makes people say really very foolish things at times. So it's good to have someone running interference with you under the circumstances.
That's exactly the description.
How much grief and death have you encountered as a journalist? It's an odd question, I know, but you're no stranger to this. So I suppose I'm a little surprised by, well, not surprised, but I don't know, that you're so undone by death, even if it is your mother's death.
Of course, that is the business, the traffic, the currency of my work is death and a great deal of despair and suffering in all its forms, and it is something that I have confronted my entire working life and thought about a great deal, and thought about how I talk to people, and I've been with people who are dying, who've died.
Have you been in the situations where there's mass grief after a disaster?
So mass grief mass grief is an extraordinary thing. I came across mass grief in the after the Asian tsunami, when you have tens of thousands of people who have died, and in that extraordinary case you had the locals in a sort of mass distress because those people hadn't been buried and they could hear them crying, particularly the children in the riverbeds at night, and so they needed a religious man to come to Arche to allow the dead to rest. So that's being confronted with mass grief, and then there is the individual grief that I've come across so many times. And it's not that it has nothing to do with the way you experience it yourself, but nothing. There is nothing that can prepare you for the moment of losing your last parent, and I think losing your mother. It's whether the relationship is a good one or a bad one, it's the end of one of the most significant things in your life. That's such a banal thing to say, but I don't think it can be prepared for, notwithstanding the amount of grief and suffering that I've known.
So there you are on the plane, on the flight back, and this, even though the plane's full of people, there's something quite almost lonely about being way up in the sky like that. Were you dreading, did you have dread in you on the way back to England?
Yes, although the only thing about the flight is it's contained nature. So you know that at least, even though you have dread, you know that there's a certain amount of time before which you will have to confront it. So there's a sort of strange other, it's not quite safe up there, but you're not going anywhere for a minute. But it was building slowly in the pit of my stomach, and the awful moment when the light came through the windows in the morning, because so often those flights back to the UK arrive in the morning. So you're going from night to day, and in the day you know that that's where you're going to face the bits that you don't want to face. So the crack of light appearing through the window on the side of the plane was a terrible moment.
So you went out to the family home in East Anglia, in England, and your brother was there to greet you. It must have been wonderful at least to have him there, who could completely understand what you were thinking and feeling.
Yes, so there was too much to say in that moment, but it was wonderful and awful actually at the same time, because it was her house, and the house is such a representation of our lives, isn't it, in all our cases. And she
and mum and dad, they hang on to the old stuff that you remember from your childhood, the old ashtray, the old picture on the wall, that stuff.
The thing that, you know, they had this, my father had a cigarette box from the Koi Golf Club in Lagos where we used to live, and I used to stroke the top of it because the middle of the cigarette box was smooth and the rest of it was stirated, so it was smooth. And then it had the word Ikoyi written on it, and I just used to read it over and over and over again because it was such a wonderful word from far away, Ikoyi, Ikoyi Golf Club, which is thoroughly banal, but Ikoyi did it for me. Yeah, so that was there.
Our kids are not going to have this because we got all our crap from IKEA. And and it's all disposable all broken. And broken. That's right, all chipboard, isn't it? But there's something eerie about being in the room with all that stuff that you know so well from your childhood all around you.
And it's a spell. It does cast a spell. But you know, I dreaded the moment of the arrival at the house because she should have been there. She'd been there for a long time. She should have been at the door. You know, it's a pull door, the pull bell, a brass pull bell, and then she would come to the door and not make a fuss because that was her way. She didn't make a fuss, but being thoroughly excited at the same time. So the wrongness of her not being there and then walking into the kitchen and stopping at the door because there were all these people there, you know, vicars and neighbours and people pouring comforting cups of tea, and it was her house and we weren't her guests and she wasn't there. So the absolute rightness of her house, because her house was perfect, and the wrongness of her absence just threw me, everything just added to the throwing of me.
Maybe that stuff feels weirdly dead without the animating spirit of the woman who once lived there.
Except it's not gone yet. So I don't know what, you know, the word numinous is a word I come back to all the time. What is it that creates the living sense in a building or a place? We don't know the answer to that. There are lots of ideas given to it in spiritual terms, in religion. But there's something. We know that a house that has a person living in it, that something of them is in the house. And it hadn't gone because, of course, she might just be out. So even though your brain knows that she's not, for the moment, it hasn't had time yet to extinguish or escape under the cracks in the door. So it's still, her spell is still completely there. It's still her house. And her house was very neat. So you didn't feel, for two reasons, you didn't feel that you could move anything because it's her house and she liked things to be neat. But also, it's still absolutely her house and she's still there, even though she's not.
All right, so this sign's still of an ongoing life.
So completely, because she fell in the kitchen and was carted off to hospital in an ambulance, so her life is ongoing. So the calendar is there with forward appointments.
Ouch. I find it suddenly
isn't
thought
it,
that.
Isn't that, yeah. Ouch? You know, there's all people who know, who've known death know the... There are so many of these little things, but I looked around the kitchen and saw all of those little sharp, had those sharp moments, the slippers, those extremely domestic, those signals of domesticity, you know, that she'd parked neatly her slippers under the stool near the Aga, an open book under her pillow upstairs was the Spectator that she was reading. There was an unfinished note on her desk, so the life continued. You know, she was expecting to come back. Her life had been interrupted.
Most poignantly, her twin brother, John, was there, still alive. Her twin brother, loss of a twin.
Yes, and that's a mystery that those of us who are not twins or haven't had them can't fully fathom. But I'd rung him walking through Sydney Airport earlier, and this is a man who's never expressed anything, any strong feeling in his life. It's just... never, he doesn't do it, said that he was distraught, which I thought was going to set us up for a much more frank conversation about what had happened. It as that isn't how it turned out, but there he was sitting in the kitchen with all the bustle. But he was sitting in the rear of the kitchen and he looked so small. You know, this person who'd been such a huge part of her life and our life was suddenly a fraction of his size and a fraction of his presence, if you like. His presence had shrunk, and it took me quite a few moments before I even noticed him in the room, which is some large part of him had gone.
Your mother's name was Marjorie. That's about the most English name of mid-century name I can possibly think of.
There
Marjorie.
You go. That's if you were writing the script, that's something that would definitely be in the list of five, wouldn't it?
Would. Whereabouts did Marjorie grow up?
So she grew up, it started in Yorkshire, and then they moved to Bristol, where she had she was a child in the war and grew up a absolutely, if you like, ordinary middle class English life, polite, well mannered, you know, the war. So that creates a whole series of impressions, obviously, on a young person and on all of those people living in England during that period of time. But otherwise, if there's such a thing, and just a normal life, decent, those notions that she grew up with, I think, were the things that she passed on to me. Old notions of loyalty, dependability, slightly unexciting, but she actually had a very exciting edge to her, but it was a very straightforward middle-class childhood.
Yeah, you said she was terrible at telling jokes, but a stickler for details.
Yes.
Would keep your dad on the straight and narrow.
Absolutely. My father was an extravagant, so I'm clearly a combination of the two. He was an extravagant, outrageously untruthful storyteller, good at it, but she was always there. It was a great one too. So he would tell his terrible stories about Africa, where the countries were muddled up, the animals were... He needed to add a little bit to everything, and she just couldn't help herself, instinctively had to bring him back to the facts.
Just like a journalist would. What took her and her family to Africa?
So my grandfather went out to then Kenya, now Kenya, to run the East African Bus Company. So he ran transport companies, and he went out there to fix it up.
This is the immediate post-colonial period,
correct.
Is it? Right.
Well, it's actually, when my father got there, we were on the... he arrived at the time of the Mau Mau, so this is the 1950s. And my grandparents went and instructed the daughters, my mother and her sister, not to come, because at the time Nairobi had a reputation for being very fast, drink, immorality, probably drugs. There was a famous club there where all sorts of things went on, and so my slightly straight grandparents thought that it was a completely inappropriate place for young women to come to.
Right, had a touch of the Shanghais about it in those
days,
didn't it?
Exactly.
And
my mother said, bugger that.
That
sounds like an awful lot of fun. And so she earned passage with her sister, and they went out there on a ship.
How did she then meet your father?
So this is good, because my grandparents chose my father, who was a Scot who'd gone there after a period in Germany after the war. He'd gone there. He lived in a hotel, the Gaylord. He had a Riley Pathfinder, for our car enthusiasts listening.
A Riley Pathfinder.
Right. He drove in the East African Grand Prix, and he was, I suspect, a little bit of a Jack the Lad, but my straight grandparents picked him as the person to show her around the colony, as they called it. So he taught her to drive in the game park, and... what followed from that was that they decided to get married, at which point my grandparents said no, because there was something in that story that didn't quite add up.
Did you ever find out what that was?
Well, this is the failing. My whole journalistic career, Richard, as you will appreciate, is about curiosity. If I have no curiosity, I have no job, because I'm supposed to want to know what's behind every story, every person, every event that I encounter. And here was a genuinely interesting story, and it had raised in me no curiosity at all. I hadn't asked any questions. I had a series of photos that didn't make any sense at all, which were their wedding photos, because they eloped, and they eloped from Nairobi to Scotland. So the wedding was
That seems backwards.
It's all completely wrong. It's not the way it should be. It wasn't out of Africa. They flew in. Well, in fact, my father went ahead, and then my mother left my grandmother sort of sobbing on the floor, on her knees, probably not the floor. There, you see, that was the Ian Ferguson side of the storytelling. I'm exaggerating a little bit, begging her not to go, imploring her, and angry. And she gets on the 5-stop aeroplane to Scotland and hands herself over to my father's slightly dour relatives. And
wow, so that would have been like Nairobi to Cairo, or something
right,
like that.
Entebbe, yes, right. And on and on, and Khartoum, and on and on, by herself.
All the way
to Scotland, where it's winter. So the wedding photos that I had been looking at all my life, it's Scotland. It's not her home in Kenya. My grandfather isn't standing next to her in the aisle. It's my uncle. And I had never, and it's Boxing Day, which is a little bit odd of the day to get married. So why had I never not looked at those pictures and went, you're in the wrong place with the wrong people at the wrong time. Why? And I only started asking these questions when my father died. And immediately there was a sort of frisson of, oh, goodness, she's going to come back here and start asking questions and churn it all up at the wrong moment. And the only thing I ever heard was somebody once whispered to me that my father might have punched someone in Nairobi. But again, my curiosity, I don't remember it being piqued, it fell away. I say that my parents, for me, were like a monolith. They just existed. I didn't have curiosity about them. I didn't wonder about, also because I was young. So if I think about it now, the vicissitudes of their life become much more clear to you as you get older yourself, whereas as a child, they just exist.
So given that she married the flash lad with the Riley Pathfinder and went off to, it wasn't Gretna Green quite, but it was Scotland.
Yeah.
Was it a happy marriage?
Yes. So, yes, it was. you know, different. They're different people. As I said, my mother, the absolute stickler for everything, and my father, not an absolute stickler for everything. Extrovert, introvert, but just not anything that I never questioned. I never questioned their happiness, really. I think I just took it. I took everything for granted. It sounds so strange, but it didn't provoke questions in me.
Maybe that's why you didn't ask questions. Mm. Yes, because it seemed stable and perhaps even boring to you.
Yes. And yet, listen to the
I know.
The elements. It's not, you know, they didn't go back to they didn't return to Kenya because they weren't welcome. They went to live in Nigeria, and they didn't see my mother. Didn't see her parents for 10 years.
They were estranged
for 10 years, and my father organised a reunion 10 years later. They parked by the side of the road on the way up to Suffolk to kind of gird themselves for the meeting. And after that, according to my mother, which sounds just totally unbelievable, it was never spoken of again. Oh, well, that is possible because these are English people after all, but that it was all sort of smoothed over.
So you folks settled in Lagos, another kind of wild old town,
yep.
In Nigeria, on the other side of Africa from Nairobi. Is that where you were born?
That's where I was born, and that's, once again, that's a little clue as to who my mother was, that when she fell pregnant and there were three children. The doctor, she went to see the doctor, and the doctor said, go and see, well, it's very simple, madam, you go see Dr. DC-10. And she waited for him to explain. He said, DC-10, you take a DC-10 to London. So white women, if the idea is white women don't have their babies in Lagos. So my mother said, but all the black women have their babies here, so I'm going to have my babies here. My father's company was so shocked, they sent a deputation to the house to get her to change her mind, but she isn't someone who would change her mind. She made decisions and she stuck to them. And she didn't dramatize. She didn't self-dramatize those decisions or make a big deal about them as one might be tempted to, given that they're quite interesting decisions. She just moved on to the next thing. So we were born in Nigeria and I was delivered by a lovely black gynecologist wearing a dinner jacket because I was born on New Year's Eve. But then this isn't my story.
One of the things we often fail to do about parents is we fail to see them as anything other than old people.
Yes.
When you look at photos of your mother as a young woman, though, with little kids, how does she appear to you?
So she's glamorous. She does. She has something which I've never had, which is poise. She always sits elegantly. I don't know because they didn't have lessons. They actually offered lessons in my school for getting in and out of sports cars, particularly low cars. You know,
what do you like getting in and out of a sports car?
I get in and out like a jackaroo. It's not good. So I don't have her poise. So she had that 1950s poise. The word's gone away because we don't have it anymore. Or it's very, very, it's not a common thing. It's not widely. I want to say the French word for some reason keeps forcing itself into my head.
It's gone the way of finishing school.
Yes.
What is the French word?
Well, I was going to say it's not widespread. So it's not répandu. We just don't think, we don't use that word very often because it's not something that all of us have. So she had that, and I have pictures of her. They used to go out to the Bagatelle nightclub in Lagos, and she used to do this quite a lot. She would have dresses made out of local fabrics. So when we went on holiday, she would dress us all the same for the plane, because for us air travel was always a formal business, and I did sort of carry on with that a bit. And then
you dress up for air travel?
Yes. So we
God, I wish that custom had come back.
Yes, I know. Yeah. I know. Look at us. Look at us now. So I made my children wear matching jackets until they were old enough to look slovenly, and we'd go places, and my mother would have outfits made for the return, all matching. So, but she would have outfits made, and she'd go dancing at the Bagatelle in her outfit. But interestingly, never in any photo of her I've ever seen, she's never looking at the camera. She's always looking, she had this quality, she was always looking away as if she knew something that you didn't. Just a little bit of something withheld, which is something I think that she had. It may be as simple as shyness. She might just say, I'm shy, but there is a quality in her that suggests I might just know something that I'm not going to tell you about. A little withholding.
She keeps the best of herself to herself when she does that.
Yes.
You write that your mother thought it was disloyal to the present to live in the past. She wasn't nostalgic. It was disloyal to the present to live in the past. I love that line. I like that very much about her.
And I got it from her too. And I think It's most clearly demonstrated when she moves to Scotland from Nigeria. Now, that's a hell of a move. It was the Biafran War had broken out, although she had refused to be evacuated in the first instance, as the American wives were, she says a bit unkindly. She goes to get her hair done instead, and they hang on a bit, but then eventually they get back to Aberdeen, where it's very cold and dark, and she loved Africa, and she never complained, never ever talked about when I was in Africa, which a lot of English people I knew did, because there were a lot of people returning from the former colonies at that time. And so it is a sentence that you heard a lot, when I was in here or there. And she didn't. She moved immediately to the present and felt that it was wrong to live somewhere else in your head or your heart.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
Sarah Ferguson is with me today, one of the ABC's most distinguished investigative journalists, and every instinct in her tells her not to talk about herself. So it's a real big deal that she's actually told this story about her mother, whom she loved absolutely dearly. It is really hard for you to talk about this, Sarah, isn't it?
It's not that it's hard, it's just that it would otherwise be wrong. Because you don't talk about yourself. The point of my work is to talk about other people, to find out about them. And so I don't belong to that. As long as I'm present and thoughtful, I don't need to bring myself to it. I don't need to tell the people that I'm interviewing about myself. And so the very notion of writing about myself is anathema. So when it was proposed by the publisher, my first instinct was, no. But this all went very fast, no. And secondly, it's such a small story. So on the no, I turned that around quickly because I realised it's a small thing, but my whole life, as you've referred to it, is confronting hard things. And I'm at the harder, darker end of the universe in my work. And it occurred to me that writing a small book about something as simple as a good relationship and a loving relationship, that was enough just once.
This is the story in here that completely kills me about you, Sarah. Most of your friends at the time, in your teenage years, were into Duran Duran, The Cure, Depeche Mode. Who was your fanish correspondence with?
Well, it's, let me be honest that when you said all of those, named all of those bands, snatches of music did play in my head. But in my correspondence was with Philip Larkin.
Philip Larkin, England's greatest post-war poet, arguably.
Yes, I'm with you.
And I would certainly say that myself. Yep. Philip Larkin, the most miserable poet, librarian, working in Hull Library, as I recall, and you were writing a letter to him. Did he write back?
So he did. When I had read my first collection of Philip Larkin poems, I was puzzled by how miserable he thought life was. And here I was living in the Essex countryside with a fairly straightforward life that seemed to be quite a lot of fun. And so I thought that it was an interesting question to ask him, why he was so convinced that life was drear and grim and just waiting for disappointment and death. And so I wrote him a letter questioning his take on life.
Carefully. Dear Mr. Larkin.
Dear Mr. Larkin, I notice in your poem, and off I went, and he wrote back and said, I refer you to Dockery and Sons, Life is First Boredom, Then Fear. So Philip Larkin, so he writes, and so we have a correspondence.
And what happened to those letters?
Oh. So this is the only people, a few people have asked me, have I omitted all the nasty bits? What happens, of course, when somebody dies is that the hard bits, the frayed edges of the cloth, if you like, they fall away and you smooth it over very quickly. It's just there wasn't a great deal of awful things to omit, but I'd be so bold as to say that I never forgave her for this because I had a chest of juvenilia, which was my own fine writings, and they obviously did belong in the incinerator, but all sorts of other things, correspondence, because I did tend to write a few letters here and there, and my letters from Philip Larkin, obviously precious as can be. And I moved to Paris and I used to come home and say, where's my stuff? Where's my stuff? Where's my stuff? And my mother would say it very unusually, dishonestly, it's in the attic. And so one year when I came home, I said, right, we're going to the attic this time. And we went up the creaky stairs to the attic and there was an empty attic with the eaves denuded of anything, no stuff, no nothing.
What had she done with those letters?
She'd thrown them all out because she had overreached and decided that I too should be loyal to the present, and that whatever lay in that juvenilia was dangerous and might come back and disturb my current life, and so it mustn't to be. Now she did overreach.
That's
bad, isn't it?
That is bad, but that's the worst thing she did.
Yes, it's the worst thing she did, and I say quite bluntly that I have never forgiven her, because I haven't.
So there you are, you're back in England, your mother's just died, and there's this moment when you know you're going into the morgue to see her. How hard was it for you to walk into that room?
Well, you wouldn't want anyone to have to do that. And the other thing about me is that I'm squeamish, so I'm, again, come across...
Squeamish?
I'm squeamish. I'm really squeemish.
Well, you can't be squeamish.
I am.
You've reported on the Boxing Day tsunami. No one can do that
and
be squeamish.
And, you know, in all its...
You mean squeamish about blood or death or what?
I'm squeamish about images that I know my mind's eye will retain and punish me with later. So I know that I know the way my memory works, and that when it sees something, it holds it in sharp focus. And so while I don't avoid nasty scenes for work, I'm careful about what I allow myself to see, because I know I'm going to have to live with it. So going to see her in the morgue, there was a question in my head as to whether I could bear it, partly out of squeamishness, but also that terrible fear that anybody who's lost someone dear to them would know, which is funk the bureaucracy. You know, you don't want to bump into the ugly, uncaring side of bureaucracy. So I was as worried about a sort of seeing a lack of care as much as I was about seeing something ill. But there was quite a bit of fear for the squeamish side of me. So I had to drive myself to do that.
Was your brother with you or Tony?
So we went, it's funny, my husband's called Tony, my brother's called Anthony, and his wife is called Sarah. So
it's two Tonys and Sarahs,
yeah, so the Antonys and the Sarahs went in the car together to the morgue.
So all four of you went in together?
We all went together, and we went in sort of single file. And
how did you go?
I ran out. So the first thing I did was run out.
What did you see her in the distance or something?
Yes, so I could see her. You know, there's a platform. She's on a platform beneath the shroud, up to the chin, and it's just wrong. The rooms are wrong. This is what I mean about bumping into things that are wrong. You know, morgues are set up to, they borrow little notes from religion, so they've got that sort of, it's quasi religion. We don't know what to do with dead bodies in hospitals. And obviously what you're afraid of is a tray or something gruesome. But this is it. I found this in, it's difficult enough. I understand that you have to do that. But this, it doesn't...
Is that really what's bothering you?
No, of course it isn't.
You're telling yourself that you're worried about something inappropriate when really there's the fact of your mother's dead body.
Yeah, all right. Fair enough. I completely accept that that is exactly the truth. These are all just the...
It's not really
the outer edges. No, it's the fact that she's there. And I don't know what it's going to be like to see her. So I run out, and thank you for holding me to the truth of that moment, because I was backing away at 100 miles an hour, because this is the where, you know, if you're rubber and road, here it is. So I go back in and I go out, and I go in and out a few times before I can stay. And then I stand at the end of the bed, and then I edge very slowly up the side of the platform, or the bed, if you like, so that I'm getting close to the head. But it took, you know, it took me a long time to get there. And then I ran out again, and my brother and his wife were in the waiting room, and I said to them, can I touch her, do you think? I don't know whether I was asking for permission or whether they, I'm not sure why I was asking, but they said I probably could. So I went back in and made my way back to her head. And also in that moment, of course, as we know, our dead cells are not ourselves. They don't look like us.
They don't look the same.
They don't look the same. No. But then I suddenly saw her somewhere in the construction of the face. I suddenly caught her. And so I stroked her hair and said sweet words to her, and then accidentally sort of bumped into her face, which made me recoil, because then you are absolutely with death, because that is an unyielding thing, the dead body. But then I went in again, if you like, and went to stroke her and spoke gently to her.
That helps a lot, doesn't it? You find some tenderness, and then that it completely conquers the fear. in that moment.
I think tenderness in those moments. So where these moments are hard and we're saying we wouldn't like them ideally to be in a morgue, I think I don't know how you get from I knew she was alive to she's dead unless you can go through that moment, each to their own, no judgment in grief. But if you wanted to and couldn't, I think that's a terrible sadness.
Otherwise, it's like they've been teleported off the Earth.
Yes, and they're on another planet somewhere. Which, you know, that or the strangest thing, I, who have no religion, how you manage your concept of the soul in those immediate moments after death. They are, when I was talking before about the numinousness of the house, where the body and the soul is in those moments and how it forms and reforms and fades away and then reforms in your imagination, I think is just an endlessly fascinating thing. I don't know what's at the heart of it, but I know that it was a very strange thing in the days afterwards dealing with my sense of her.
In the world of magical thinking there.
In the world of magical thinking.
You can't help but have those thoughts. Are you still in that world?
I'm still in that world. In fact, I didn't get... I said in the days afterwards, that's not quite right, actually, because it took me... I think in the days afterwards, you're in the full shock of final and death and the big granite words where there's nowhere for your mind to go and you can barely make it settle. I think it's in the period after that. And somebody told me that the conversation continues. It's a very smart, intuitive person, and I didn't understand at the time because the voice was totally lost to me in the shock, but then it did return. There is something that becomes audible, but it took a little while for me to hear it again.
It was decided there was a need for a coronial inquest into your mother's death because the hospital couldn't really fully and satisfactorily explain her death. You said she had a fall?
Yeah, so she had a fall. She broke her hip.
Was it a stroke or was it?
No, she just... She
said a fall.
She had a fall, so there was no particular explanation for that. She had a fall and somebody found her. She was packed off to hospital and she'd broken her hip. Now, this is an object lesson for other people that because so many people have hip replacements now, we tend to think of them as being routine. And this is where the hospital fell down in many ways, but it fell down because she had a pulmonary embolism before the operation to replace her neck or femur. They didn't call us, and so we didn't know that she had gone in for this relatively, well, I say it's not routine for her age group, but it's still routine, but they didn't call, so nobody knew. So she went in to have the operation, was getting ready for the operation, and had a pulmonary embolism. And because the hospital was too full, they put her in the ordinary recovery ward when she shouldn't have been in the recovery ward. They didn't call anybody. And 12 hours later, she died. But when, as you said, there was no adequate explanation and they rang us. So they were holding the body and doing postmortems, all those words you don't want anywhere near your loved one. And if you're lucky, you don't have them. And if you're unlucky, you do. And they announced there was going to be an inquest. That was a grim day because then you know that the hall you're in is getting longer.
And what was going to be your role at that inquest?
So then the system begins. So this is something I know very well, which is the way systems operate to protect themselves, how organisations close ranks. This is the meat and potatoes of my work at Four Corners and my work as a journalist for years. We all know this is what systems do. This is how organisations behave. So they had begun that process and the inquest was doing its slightly faux, caring, respectful, making those noises until we started pushing back and then they started getting quite aggressive. So
it's kind of amazing.
Off to the races.
You're in this kind of unknown territory, but then the first hint of arse covering and out comes the journalist
and you. And she wouldn't have had it because when the inquest was put for December, I came back to Australia and a number of people said to me, you shouldn't go, why would you go? She wouldn't want you to go. And I thought, you know, bloody hell, she would. She would want me to go because she would not accept cant.
Why would people say that to you? Wouldn't have wanted you to go?
You know, because it hurts, because it's going to make you cry. But it's because it's going to make me sad and they don't want me to be sad.
But you did go to your mother's inquest.
Yes, of course.
Did that help with journalist Sarah could step up and go, it's all right, grieving, wounded Sarah, daughter Sarah, journalist Sarah's going to take over for a bit.
It's okay. It wasn't take over. It was, well, you sit there and I'll sit here. So sad Sarah can be over there. It was two separate tracks. And then occasionally they would converge and they were very hard moments because I would get into reading hospital reports, hundreds and hundreds of pages.
Hospital reports that were sent to you on the Friday before the Monday inquest.
With bits missing. It's just so, hello, the system.
Yeah.
Mind you, we had elected not to have lawyers. And so I suppose if we'd had lawyers, we would have got them earlier. So the inquest rings one day and says, will you have lawyers? And we thought, no, we're not going to have. We don't think it's the most complicated case. We don't think this is the crime of the century. We just want them to tell the truth and stop the arse covering. And where there are failures for them to be admitted. But of course, what they think is we're going to sue. But anyway, we elected, as when my father died, I wanted to dig his grave and carry his body from the house over my shoulder and drive the hearse, making sure nothing went wrong. In this case, same thing. I wanted to take it to the end.
So you acted for yourself. This is England. Were they aware that they had one of Australia's most dedicated investigative journalists on their case acting for assault?
Well, let's just say that I've had a lot of experience in these things. So no, they didn't. And I was greatly helped by the fact that the night before we arrived for the opening of the inquest, the heating in my mother's house had broken down. You know, houses punish you when you leave them. And so the heating had broken down. One forgets how unbelievably cold England can be. It seems to be a mild place just with chilly winters. It was freezing cold. So we desecrated her cupboards by going through them looking for woolly things and found all sorts of mohair and woolen bits and pieces and hats and so on, so that the next morning when we went to the inquest...
So you and Tony Jones are sitting there side by side like a couple of... Inuit.
Like Inuit fishermen, folk, right, with my brother and his wife and their children sort of wrapped in whatever we could find. And Tony said quite reasonably, couldn't we go to a hotel? Like, out of the question. You know, we can't possibly leave the house. It'll fall down. I just couldn't leave it. And so he said, but it's freezing. It was below zero. So we really looked like the Clampets. Got up in the morning, couldn't have a shower. Tony poured a jug of hot water over my head in order for me to wash my hair. And it was so cold, I tell you, Richard, I couldn't think. I don't know how people do it, because in cold countries, I was having my last conversation with a professor of emergency medicine in Sydney, because the Australians came to the party in the most magnificent way to help me. But I could barely hold myself together because I was so cold. And I went to the inquest and I'd pulled a jumper from my mother's cupboard, but it was unusually for her undarned. But it was her gardening jumper. And we're sitting in the inquest and it's just opened and it's all very heavy and formal, as it should be. And I look down and I realise that I'm wearing this rotten old jumper with holes in the elbows, and thought to myself, oh good, because I must look like a wretch. So Mr. Fancy Pants lawyer up the table from me with his shiny suit is going to be thinking, what a walkover this is going to be. And I could see every moment of his plotted strategy to arrive at the point where the coroner was supposed to deliver a verdict of natural causes. Tied up neatly, no chance, because you can't really sue after natural causes. Off you go, hospital trust, bingo.
What were you able to get out of that inquest? Could you get the hospital to admit or the coroner to find that there had been some negligence?
So not. We had small victories, but they were not small victories in that at the beginning of the inquest, the coroner had accepted the hospital's investigation. So notwithstanding the fact that one of the key pages from the hospital's 500-page report was missing.
So the hospital investigated itself here?
Yes, it had. Right, and it had done lots of fish diagrams and all kinds of fancy diagrams to show how they had really done quite a good job, and here are a couple of little tiny bits of cheese that we can offer to these bereaved mice so that they'll take them and run away, which is, we're terribly sorry we didn't call you. And it was so staged. At the moment that the chief hospital investigator came to the moment that she'd been prepped to say by the lawyers very clearly, which was, we're very sorry for not calling, she's turned to me theatrically and overemphasized their apology. Clearly it had been rehearsed. And like, you don't think I'm going to buy that one, do you, for a moment? The cheeky lawyer from up the table overreached himself, and that gave me an opening, because it was very clear that the evidence didn't support a finding of natural causes, that there were at least two points where things could have gone differently. Now, it might not have changed the outcome. And the other lovely thing about being self-represented is that the coroner gave me a bit of leeway, and the poor hospital lawyer was just beside himself because I kept going and going and going and going and going and going. And he kept asking the coroner to make me stop. And it meant that we got, some of these doctors weren't terribly well prepared, so it meant we got a bit more out of them than we might have.
So in the end, there was a finding.
So there was a finding that the coroner said she was minded, she had been about to give a verdict of natural causes, and that after the last intervention, after the lawyer went too far, she said, I'm now minded to change that view, I'm going to go away and deliver what's called a narrative verdict, where they lay out what's gone wrong, which means that the avenue to legal action, which we didn't want, was now wide open for the hospital trust, and it also meant that they have to change the way they treat people like my mother.
But you didn't want to sue, you said.
No, because it wasn't gross. It was wrong. It was careless. She could have lived longer. They didn't give her the best chance. They did a lot of things wrong, but I would not put it in the category of gross. And that's enough, I think. My mother wouldn't have wanted us to sue.
When you got back to her home, what was the first thing you did?
Well, before I left, I kissed the walls, because that's what it was, a custom in the part of Africa that she had lived in, where you kiss the walls when you're leaving and you kiss each wall of the house. And I just tried to find something that I could take with me from that feeling that I had in her house. I don't know what it is about people of a certain age, but there is a stillness in their house that we don't have. Obviously, we have children and clatter and noise and so on, but there's something greater than that, a stillness of someone who is in a contemplative period of their life that enters the microbes of the house. And I tried to take something of that with me.
And you kiss the walls, you get it right up close to it, and you taste it.
Yeah, that's right.
And you smell it, don't you, when you
and
do
it's
that?
Obviously not bodily, but it's intimate. Yes. It's intimate to their life.
Have you been able to pack up her house?
No. I took.
How long ago was
it? So it was in September. It was September.
2017.
2017. Yeah. So, I went back for the inquest. I swiped a few coffee spoons in my pocket, which felt like I wasn't really
swiping there. You
know,
were, Sarah.
I mean, I know. I did ask my brother. Right. That, you know, is it okay? I'm short of coffee spoons.
Swiping.
I know, but
swiping.
It still feels like they're.
That's so interesting.
Well, I feel like there should be, you know, I know there's a thing called probate, but I also feel like somebody should stand over me and say, there's a decree where you're now allowed to take the coffee spoons.
Sounds to me like you think, I've stolen them because mother might want them
later.
Well,
exactly. There is that. You know, that means I'm formally breaking the spell. And so it didn't work. You know, I tried to tidy one drawer and it was just completely hopeless. Couldn't do it.
Did I get the sense earlier that you're talking to her?
Yes. Yeah, so that was the thing, the little thread, I mean, an audible thread that I heard when I went back to England for the inquest. I just started to hear a little tiny bit of her voice. And I think our voices are quite alike and probably getting a bit more alike. I think I've probably shifted just very slightly back towards her voice, but we do sound alike. And I can hear her voice now a little bit. And if I pull on that audible thread, I can get something like a conversation. Not a long conversation, but a little one.
Can you ask her questions and do you get answers from her?
It's comforting is what it is. It's more telling than, so it's not a true conversation, but I can tell her things. And then sometimes when I'm being very, when I'm being tough on myself, it makes me feel sad because there isn't a voice that you can hear, and their voice is so precious. It's like handwriting. The voice and the handwriting are those things that take you straight back to them. So if I'm being a bit hard on myself, I'll say there's nothing there, but other times I can hear it.
Do you feel a presence? Like, have you had a situation where an animal's walked into the room and you go, oh, that's her? Have you had that?
It's interesting. I had it more when my father died because we were with him for a couple of weeks before he died. I think because I lived here and she lived there, and so our visits were with great big gaps in between, it was less of a quotidian exchange. And so I think you have that strongly, but I think it comes out of something closer to the daily exchange than it did with these big gaps in between.
What are the lessons of grief for you, of this grief?
Well, not to judge anybody else's grief. I think I was already kind, and I'm kinder to people who've experienced it. I wasn't unkind before, but I think very carefully about how, not about the fact that it happened to me, so I get it, but how they are experiencing it in a very detailed way. So that most important thing of all, which is not to think about yourself, but to think about the other person. So just to make me think really carefully about how they are experiencing it, and try not to judge those people who don't want to talk about it at all, like my uncle, you know, who I was quite close to, but told me that he couldn't see the point of the inquest and it wouldn't change anything, and, you know, thought we should just let it go at that point, and not to judge him for thinking that, or to think that it's wrong, because I'm no longer certain about what's right and wrong about grief.
You've just given me such a lovely sense of your mother, and it's clear she's in her fullness. She's in your head at the moment. You and I never would have had this conversation in a million years before she died. We wouldn't have, would we? This wouldn't have happened.
I wouldn't have talked about any of these things.
No.
I would have thought that it was wrong, selfish, froward, as they used to say in English.
Froward, wow.
You know, why would I push myself forward? Mm-hmm. If you want to, I have a body of work. It's sort of reasonably interesting at times. I'd talk about that, but I've got no business being in there. And so the liberating question of the person who asked me to do it, I am forever grateful, because this sounds so naff, really, I have to say, but because we overuse this thing, but
with it, Ferguson.
It's a privilege, for God damn it, it's a privilege, because I get to talk about it, something that's so absolutely precious to me. She was so gentle, such an exquisitely kind person, and I get to talk about her. And other people, you know what, we hurry them along, as we were saying before, we shut them down, and here I am having a lovely conversation with a thoughtful person about her. What chance, what luck have I?
Well, I feel I've just met Marjorie and she's not been in the room. And so for that, I'm very grateful. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you, Mr. Feidler.
Sarah, sounds like you're in school.
Yep.
Sarah Ferguson's book is simply called On Mother. And she is, of course, the presenter of Four Corners on ABC TV. Sarah Konoski will be with you tomorrow. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.